Hi folks, my name is Tim Plett. Welcome to the Tables Podcast. I'm attaching this audio intro to The Light at the End of the Tunnel, Parts 2 and 3, to explain a bit of a detail that might help listeners make sense of how we've laid this out. When I presented this material to our community in Talkie Bits early in November of 2020, I did it in two parts, and they were pretty long, at least in our context, especially the second one. There's lots of very helpful, very pragmatic material in here. I didn't want to truncate it more than necessary, and the result is longer audio pieces. So, due to the limitations of our podcast media, they don't fit into parts one and two online, and I've divided the second part into parts two and three. So, the one you're listening to right now is part two. I'll attach an intro to part three as well. We'll post them at the same time. But there will now be parts 1, 2, and 3. I don't want to belabor this. Just want folks to not be confused. In part 2, which you're about to listen to, I'll reiterate some of what we covered in part 1, which we posted the previous week. And then I'll take us a little bit further into some nuance about ways that we can get stuck in the stress tunnel, which is what we've been talking about. And then in part 3, I'll open up some really hands-on practical ideas about what we can do to get unstuck if we find ourselves buried in stress that's coming in faster than we can siphon it off. I hope you find this material both enjoyable and helpful. I know that that's been my experience with it, and I'm really pleased to pass it on. Morning all. Zach, Cheryl, Abby, Owen. Oh man. You know what? Tim Penner, I really appreciated what you wrote alongside what Cheryl and Zach were up to this morning and the kids, and how it just reminded me of how kind of perspective is so powerful. Because you, Tim and Jane and Cheryl and Zach, you're both families with, you know, school age kids and younger. And there's a unique kind of interaction in a household with kids of that age that, you know, I remember but don't live in. And so, I mean, I was, as is so often the case, when the families in our community just sort of honestly share their, not just their the thing they're making, if you want to say it that way, you know, the music or leading community time. And Zach, thank you for your just really thoughtful leadership of that this morning. So, and facilitation of it. I appreciate and enjoy that a great deal. And when we share these things that we're sort of making, that's this part of this live event, you know, this gathering online, and we also share our lives. And I was having a conversation with somebody about this just the other day, about how this season has given us glimpses into one another's lives at home in ways that would never have happened otherwise. And for my part, at least, I cherish those. I really do. I feel all the feels. It's just when I get to look into people's lives like that. And I was wishing for Zoom this morning instead of the one-way thing of Facebook Live, because, I mean, not because I wanted you to see me, but because I wanted to share what I was feeling with you, which was, I mean, I was laughing. I was tearing up. I was clapping my hands. I'm all alone in this room with my dog, and I'm just sort of having this whole range experience, because what you were bringing to us had this absolute sense of being a real thing, despite all the mediation, you know, all the screens in between. And I just felt like, man, if there is a way to sort of overcome technology, that's got to be one of the keys, is to just bring something that is deeply authentic to whatever we're able to share with one another in a season like this. So, thank you. So good to be with you and with everyone who's joined us live. Well, welcome. Zach, I want to thank you too for reminding us of Indigenous Veterans Day. I was driving down Ellis last week, and there's a large mural on the side of one of the buildings there that marks some outstanding Indigenous Canadian military figures, heroes, I suppose we can use that language as well. And I was reminded of how extraordinary those chapters in the history of the Dominion are. And no less in the American story. In fact, I mean, the scale obviously is larger, but when I meet an indigenous person that has retained something beautiful from their encounters with Christianity, I have a similar sensation inside of me to when I think about why an indigenous person or a black person or other person of color would have chosen to serve their country militarily at the point in history when, you know, the Great Wars happened, for instance, or Vietnam in the case of the U.S. And there's something inside of me that just feels like I've been taken into the terrain of something really mysterious and profound. And I'm not going to say any more about that, except to have that be the way in which I mark my own gratitude for being graciously welcomed to live and work, and for this community to gather on Treaty One land and to step into a kind of another aspect of that mystery, I think, that would provoke someone to serve an idea of nationhood that might be profoundly different from any idea in their culture of origin. Well, let's stop and breathe together. We'll talk more about what breathing together does in our bodies here as we go, as it turns out. It's not why we're breathing together, but there'll be a connection there that's overt this morning in a way that doesn't always happen. So let's just do a very simple thing together this morning in terms of our breathing. So in through your nose. For me, I fill up on a count of three, just three, 1,001, 1,003 seconds, all the way down. Fill your whole torso, your whole trunk up with the life-giving stuff that is oxygen. With the breath of life, cradle your breath for that same amount of time, and then breathe it all the way out. And let's do five rounds of that. And this morning I would invite you, if you're participating in this, and if you're just dropping in, or if you're new to the community and you're watching this another time, or you're listening to the podcast, just two things. One is, this is an invitation. It's not an obligation. It's a regular ritual in our gathering, something we regularly do, but not something anyone's obliged to be a part of. So if you are participating, oh, I should just add one other thing. If you're catching this on the podcast, I haven't mentioned this for a while, so I wanted to revisit it. I'll shorten this on the podcast, so there won't be like a long period of silence, which is an odd thing in a podcast. but you can just hit pause if you want to stop and breathe with the community the way we've breathed together this morning. The one other thing, with our hands, we're talking a lot this morning about our bodies and how things work in our bodies and the connection between mind and body a little bit as well. And so what I would like to do is invite us this morning to do something we've done before. So as we breathe, so five rounds of our breathing, just with each round, just interlock one more finger, sort of just take your hands and it's kind of like put them together, sort of one finger at a time. So that by the end of five rounds, your hands are interlocked with one another. All right, you're connected to yourself. All right, so let's breathe together and interlock our hands and get our minds and our bodies and our spirits into the same space, and then we'll do some exploring together. Okay, here we go. Peace, everybody. Thank you. All right. So we have been doing something a little bit unusual last week and this week, unusual in our context. Sequential attendance is not one of our community, outstanding community features, all to the good in terms of ways we interact when we're embodied together in the same space, also true online, I think maybe even in a more exaggerated way in some ways. But in any case, I mention it just because this is sequential. This is very much a part one, part two sort of talky bits. Just in case you weren't around last week or you're just dropping in, I'm going to give a brief summary of last week. Also, if you're like me, life just crowds in and you forget things. I mean, if this isn't top of mind for you, it is for me because I'm working on it all week, but it wouldn't be for anybody else probably, except coincidentally. So things just, you know, drift away. So I'm going to refresh this just a little bit for all of us, and then we can get into part two. All right. So started off last week with a rather cursory look at one of the big reasons why Christianity as a religion tends to be so hard on bodies and things having to do with the body. I'm not going to revisit that in this summary. Most of us have probably had our own experiences of some sort with that to reference. So I'm going to sort of get on with some kind of an attempt at providing information that I hope can help us with what I'm thinking of as sort of a practical recovery from that and movement beyond that. In general terms, we are exploring how emotions work. And we're doing that with a particular focus on the emotion of stress, not least of all because it's one that most of us probably have in common these days. We're also focusing in on how stress works, and in particular on how it works in our bodies, and on how knowing how our bodies experience emotion can better equip us to respond constructively, and can teach us. We can learn how to work through our emotions and feel better, as well as making room for the next emotion that might come along. You can think about this in general terms as well as a movement toward peace, which is a real feature for me in my view of the world, both in terms of aspirationally and also in terms of just trying to watch for and participate in it wherever I can. So this can all be part of a movement toward that bigger idea, if you will. My primary sources for last week and this week are a book by Doctors Emily and Amelia Nagoski, sisters, twins as it turns out, which if you ever listen to them talk about their book can be quite intriguing in their interaction. The book is called Burnout, The Secret of Unlocking the Stress Cycle. And they also conducted a longer interview with Brené Brown about the book and its content that's been really helpful to me. So those are primary sources for me. Last week, we explored how emotions are, and these are really fundamental ideas to this whole exploration, okay? We explored how emotions are neurological events. Emotions happen in our bodies. When we feel things, we do that with our bodies, which might sound really dead obvious, but a lot of the way we deal with emotions ends up being in our head. A lot of the ways we're taught about it is about in our something in our mind, our ideas, and they're in our bodies. They are just very body things. When we feel an emotion, that activates our entire sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. That system takes up our whole body. It goes from the top of our head to the tip of our toes. It covers our entire skin and it reaches beyond our skin. So it's a hugely impactful part of how we experience the world. We introduced last week the metaphor of the experience of our emotions being like going through a tunnel. Then we need to travel all the way through our emotions to get to the end and move forward. And of course, that also means we can get stuck in them. Because emotions are neurological events, they're cyclic. They have a beginning, they have a middle, and they have an end, and we can move through them. And if we don't move through them, it can make us sick. It can make us really sick. So this is very important on a bunch of levels. And if you want the fuller version of all of that, the video from last week's up on the Facebook page. You have to scroll down a little bit to find it, but it is there. And of course, it's also available as a podcast on our website if you want to pop in your earbuds and take that information in without it being, tied to a screen. So we left off last week with the question, if we get hung up in the stress tunnel, because stress is our example emotion, right? The one we're focusing on. How can we get unstuck? How can we get through the tunnel and move on? So that's what we're digging into this morning. And again, this is very pragmatic stuff. And it's very hands-on because as much as I love a good idea, and I do, sometimes we just need tools we can get our hands on so we can get to work. And also, this is not unusual, but I really want to make this clear this morning. I'm talking to myself. I'm not coming to you as an expert on any of this. I'm coming to you full on as a learner in this, which I find really exciting, motivating space to be in personally. And I hope some of that comes through as well, of course. But even if none of this helps you, it's helping me. So thanks for listening. Anyway, very practical. If this feels a little bit seminary at certain points, it's just because there's lots of good information here. And my hope is that if you hit something and we just sort of roar by it, you can come back and revisit it one way or another. All right. So to this sort of central question that we're exploring in our talkie bit this morning, if we get hung up in the stress tunnel, how can we get unstuck? How can we get through the tunnel and move on? Well, part one is to differentiate are stressors from our stress. And we touched on this briefly last week, but I want to expand on it a little bit. Stressors are usually, and we'll talk about the exception in a moment, but stressors are usually external. Work, kids, money, oppressive systems. They're the things, the events in our life that activate our stress response, that fire up that whole system in us that responds to stress. Okay, so that's what stressors are. Now, some are internal, and this is especially the case with things like body self-criticism. It's a very internal stress. We carry it around with us. We don't need an event. We've got it with us all the time if that's something we're wrestling with. So body things are can be internal stressors, and also trauma can be an internal stressor. So some examples of the exception to the fact that usually the things that stress us come from outside. Now, stress, as distinct from stressors, stress itself is what happens in our bodies. So when we encounter a stressor, we experience stress. Stress is what goes off in our body. It's like a chemical stew. It's just this melange of things that fires off inside of us when we experience stress. And it's designed to fire us up. It's designed to equip our bodies to deal with the stressor. So that's what's going on. This is where this whole process took a turn when I was learning about it initially that I wasn't expecting. And this is interesting. When I heard the interview with the book's authors, one of them told a story about being chased by a hippo. Not an actual story, a made-up story. They made it up because their twin thinks hippos are the most interesting, you know, animals in the world. I don't know if you've ever seen a hippo up close. Hopefully in the zoo, they're incredibly dangerous. But they're also very comical looking. And so she tells a story about trying to imagine you're being chased by a hippo. So I'm already thinking this is kind of funny, right? But it's also sort of terrifying. So you imagine that you are being chased by a hippo and you're doing what you would naturally do if you were being chased by a hippo. You are running for your life. Now, hippos are sprinters. They don't have a lot of endurance. They're sort of like, they're like bears that way. They can go pretty fast, but not for very long. Humans can run for quite a long time, and so you just like dig deep, you find your inner marathoner or whatever, you're just booking it, and you're getting away from the hippo but not sure you can hang on, and you're just like tearing along, and the hippo's kind of coming for you, and there's somebody, you run past a house and there's somebody standing on their front porch, and they see what's happening and they wave to you and they yell, "Come in here," and they open the door, and you like whip into the house and they slam the door shut, and the hippo's like screeches to a halt outside the door. And I don't know how smart hippos are, but this one's not that bright. And they're like, oh, all gone. And they give up and they go away. All right. And you are inside the house and you feel all the feels, right? Like you are so glad to be alive. Life has never been better. The sun is brighter than it's ever been. The sky is an improbable shade of blue. Like life is good. You love your friends. You love your family. You're so grateful. You're just feeling it, right? Now, our logical brain might think that it's the hippo giving up and going away that makes us feel that way. The removal of the stressor that makes us feel that way. But, and this is the twist, this is what I wasn't expecting, it's actually the running and the connection with the other person that are making us feel that way. Right? Now, so this is fascinating to me. Those are the messages that our bodies understand. Those are the things, the running and the connection with the other person, those are the things that send the signals to our bodies that say, you have escaped the stressful situation and your body is now a safe place for you to be. Your body is no longer under threat. It is now a safe place for you to be. It's the running and the connection that sent those messages, not the hippo going away. Fascinating, right? It's the behavior, not the change in environment, that triggers the psychological change. When I heard these folks describe that, it was just like, pow. It was just one of those moments for me where I, for some reason, I could picture this distinction. And something just shifted inside of me about the way I think about stressors and stress. Short version, removing the stressors or stressor does not mean that the stress cycle is complete. It doesn't mean we don't want to remove the stressor. Of course we do. But removing the stressor does not mean that the stress cycle is complete. In other words, the other side of the coin, we don't have to wait for all the stressors to go away in order to feel better, right? The corollary. That also means that even if the stressors do go away, we have to deal with the stress separately as its whole own thing. Unless we send the necessary signals to our bodies, we stay in that stress state. The chemicals are still all churned up. They're still ripping around in our bodies, messing with our neurobiology and down the chain with a whole bunch of the other systems, major systems in our body. And unless we send those signals about safety, our digestive system, our cardiovascular system, our musculoskeletal system, our endocrine, our reproductive systems, they never get the signal that they're safe. Here's the thing. Our bodies speak body language, not logic language. We can't separate our bodies from our felt or our affect emotions. That's why we call them feelings, right? Because we feel them in our bodies. And that's why, for example, our spinal column and our brainstem are like the superhighway for all this information between our brain and our body, between our mind and our body, right? And so when we're under stress, there's all kinds of messages zipping up and down that system, and it gets pretty busy. It's rush hour. It gets cluttered. It gets noisy. It gets full of static. And so sometimes under those conditions, when we're at the peak of those stress responses, the message can't get through to our brain that we need to do something about this. And so this is why, for example, it's not uncommon when we've had a long period of stress, a major project, Tim Penner, your dissertation comes to mind as a classic example, or planning a large event. And I can feel this in my own body when I remember this for me and my experience of planning something that's just really demanding. And you can be loving it, right? It doesn't have to be negative to be stressed. And that's important too. But we're just really focused. We're working hard. And we're like, you know what? When I get this thing done, when this event's over, when I hand in the dissertation, when whatever it is that we're working toward, it's fait accompli, this is going to be great. I'm just going to relax. I'm going to take a couple days off. It's going to be awesome. And what happens? We hand in the paper. The lights go down. The show's over. The event is finished. We've accomplished the task. Whatever the thing is that we were experiencing is stress, even if it was eustress or positive stress, what happens? We get sick, right? We feel like crap. And it can happen really fast after those things, you know? And it's typical. Why does that happen? Well, because our neurological superhighway has been cluttered up with static. And the message, we've been getting sick all the way along because we haven't been dealing with the stress in our bodies. We've just been gathering it up. It's just been getting stored and stored and stored. We haven't been getting through it, partly because in that instance, the information highway that should be sending the message you need to stop and siphon off some stress has been so busy with other traffic and so staticky that the message hasn't gotten through to our brain that we're sick. And so when we stop and the stress level goes down a little bit, we downregulate our stress a bit, the message gets through and we're just like, pow, we're sick. We were sick all along. The message just wasn't getting through. So that's an important idea. Short version, stress will kill us faster than most of the stressors we encounter these days. So just because in the main, our stressors don't tend to be directly life-threatening in the environment we're in, some obvious exceptions. But short version is that stress will kill us faster than most of the stressors we encounter. So we need to learn how to give our bodies the resources that they need to get all the way through the stress cycle so that our bodies can tell our brains that it's safe again. Because that's the direction the message travels. Our bodies need to tell our brains that it's safe again. We talked about some of this last week, ways we get stuck. I want to add a little bit of nuance to that because it deeply informs our responses to those ways of getting stuck. So we touched on the problem of chronic stressors and chronic stress as one of the reasons we get stuck in the stress tunnel, about the challenge of returning every day to a stressful situation like a challenging workplace or like an ongoing pandemic, for instance, every day. Well, here's the nuance. If our stressor is constant, and if it outpaces the things we're doing to move all the way through the stress cycle, whatever we can do to kind of drain off the stress, then stress can accumulate and we can have trouble getting all the way through the tunnel. Just because it, if we think about it in a, sort of a fluid metaphor or whatever, if there's a drain that's letting the stress out and there's a funnel that's letting the stress in, if there's always stuff getting poured into the intake, even if the outflow is like wide open and we're draining the stress off as effectively and fast as we can, if the inflow is bigger than the outflow, some of it's going to accumulate. And that can be one of the reasons we get stuck. We touched on social appropriateness, this expectation that we won't express strong emotion socially or in ways other people might encounter as unsettling. This is, and both the researchers in this particular instance are women who identify that way. They identify as female. And so the expectations culturally that go with stereotypically and even sort of archetypically female or the feminine or something, they also talk about fair bit about in the book. And one of the things that they touch on is a moral philosophy. I think I'm getting the right author and title here. I don't have this in my notes, but a book called Down Girl that talks about these profoundly powerful ideas about the female or the feminine that include, in their words, we need to be pretty, happy, nice, and generous and attentive to the needs of others at all times. And there's this powerful social expectation. And with an expectation like that as a baseline, if there's an emotion you need to feel that doesn't match that, you can get stuck. What I need to do is X. What I need to express is this powerful thing. I need to work through this, but I've got these social rules that are like, no, you can't be pretty, happy, nice, generous, and attentive to the needs of others if you're also expressing this other emotion. So sometimes we can get stuck because of this social appropriateness aspect of this. Safety. It's not always safe to take on the stressor. And so we might freeze the process because of safety concerns. And just a little bit of an aside here about freeze, and this one really connected for me for lots of reasons. The basic structure of our response to stress is something that most of us have encountered in, high school biology or science or something, the idea of fight or flight. So we're familiar with the binary, the fight or flight, and increasingly we're familiar with freeze as an aspect of that. Here's the thing. There's some things about freeze that I think are worth a second look. When we encounter a stressor in this millisecond where we encounter it, our brain evaluates what the best response would be and takes us a direction. Like it just happens again in our bodies, right? So we don't know how to listen to our bodies. This is where we can get really confused. But something will happen in our body. Our brain and our body together will just going to go, what's the best response here? And sometimes in that millisecond, our brain might evaluate that situation and send us the message that the very best thing that we can do is to flee. That's the flight, right? So flight emotions are things like worry, anxiety, fear, terror. These are avoid responses. These motivate us to get out of the stressful situation by running away. Okay? So that's flight. Sometimes our brain thinks that the best thing we could do would be to fight instead of to flee. Fight is an approach response. If flight is an avoid response, they sound a lot alike. If flight, fleeing, is an avoid response, fight is an approach response. Emotions that often go with this are things like irritation, annoyance, frustration, anger, ultimately rage. These are things that push us toward the threat so we can destroy it, if that's sort of been that super fast assessment. Now, both of these, fight and flight, are action-oriented. One moves us away and the other one moves us toward, but they both push us to deal with the stressor by action. And sometimes, especially under what our brain might assess as life threat circumstances, and by the way, this isn't just always physical. All of us, I think, have probably had the experience of facing a situation where we just froze up, but it wasn't because we were about to get hit by a car. It was because somebody said something to us and we're like, and we're just stuck, right? We got that deer in the headlights moment. Sometimes when our brain assesses a situation that way, its assessment is that it would be best for us to slam on the brakes and play dead, to freeze. And then when the threat goes away, the brakes can come off and the already activated stress response can get finished off. It can get worked through. You know how you come up with the great comeback later? That's sort of the mini version of this. And we might have this experience through that whole range of encounters that I talked about. A story that one of the authors told about this, which I feel like I've seen on a, probably a National Geographic or Wild Planet or some kind of a video. At some point, my kids were watching this. It's video of this stuff always kind of makes me shudder, but it's a very graphic illustration of this, and felt like it made good sense to me. So I'll relay it. My apologies if you're sensitive to Wild Kingdom sort of directness. Gazelle's running, lion's chasing a gazelle. Lion catches up to the gazelle, jumps on it, gets its teeth into its flank, chomp. And the gazelle just sort of goes whoop and just flops over, right? It doesn't kind of keep digging and trying to get away. It just like falls on its side, just falls over. It looks like it's dead, but the lion bit it in its flank. It's not dead, right? It just stopped. And the lion's kind of like, huh, it's dead. I am the king of the jungle. And it trots off to get its queen of the jungle, right? Because the king's having a nap. Isn't this how it works in the lion kingdom? The women, you know, the females do all the work. Anyway, trots off to get the cubs so they can come back and have dinner. As soon as it trots off, camera's still on the gazelle starts to twitch, right? It starts to kind of spasm like this. That's all that chemical stew that was activated that it stopped when it froze, kind of kicking back in. It's taking its foot off the brakes, and this stuff is starting to, and then it stands up and it kind of like shakes itself off, and it runs off over the horizon. The lion comes back to the empty savanna. That's what that looks like in the wild, if you will, or in the animal kingdom. In humans, one of the ways that we see this enacted a fair bit is if we have experienced a trauma. And our brain has said the best way to deal with this is to slam on the brakes. We slammed on the brakes, but we don't know what's going on when the brake starts to let off. We haven't been made aware that this is how this works. We don't know what the spasms in our life are about, but they can just be the brake coming off of the thing that got frozen. So an interesting and important idea, I think. Now, here's the problem that started me down this little path about freeze in the first place. The problem is that there is a social ranking system that says that fight is better than freeze. That to hit the brakes when we're under stress is somehow a lesser response than to either fight or to flee, both of which are action-oriented. One toward the stressor and one away from it, but both of them, fight and flight, are stepping on the gas and not stepping on the brakes. There's a common sort of religious component to this as well, at least in my experience, which is that we may well be shamed if we hit the brakes. And we might be shamed for religious reasons or with religious rationale that says, you know what, you just don't have enough faith. If you did, you'd face this because God is with you. God is, you've got all the power of God in you. So why aren't you facing this? Well, it's because you don't have enough faith. You're faithless or you're immature spiritually. Not an uncommon thing to get leveled at someone who's frozen. Interesting aspect of this, at least in my experience, is that military metaphors tend to abound. The bottom line, though, is the same. Whatever the reason or situation is, freeze is regarded and treated as a lesser response. Or in religious language, again, one that sort of demonstrates a weak faith or a lack of maturity. But here's the thing. Freeze is a way of stepping on the brakes. It's one of an equal set of choices that our brain is assessing, looking for the best way forward. It is just as legitimate a way of responding to stress as fight or flight. It is just as heroic, if you want to use that kind of a frame. So the key to dealing with difficult emotions is actually to turn toward them. Not away from them. Turn toward ourself, and to do that with kindness and compassion for ourself. To start there rather than with self-condemnation or with shame or with self-doubt. I know that's not easy. Easy to say, not so easy to do, right? But it's the key to this. And that's true whether our nervous system, because that's what's sending the messages, tells us we should fight or flee or freeze. Equal players. Super important.